Conclusion. The future is now. Teresa Shook, a grandmother from Hawaii, was frustrated. It was November 2016, and she was alarmed by presidential candidate Donald Trump's behavior toward women, most recently revealed in the highly publicized Access Hollywood outtake in which he boasted about grabbing women's genitals. Now he had just won the election, notably with a majority of white female voters supporting him. Venting her frustration on Facebook, she came up with an idea. Why not, she suggested, stage a march in Washington, D.C. for women's equality? So she sent a private Facebook invitation to a few friends, asking if they'd like to join her. Then she went to bed. She had no idea that her single post would explode into a movement. Her suggestion caught fire. And the day after President Trump was inaugurated, the Women's March on Washington attracted more than 500,000 participants, with millions of other women around the world taking to the streets as well. They gathered not only in U.S. cities like Washington and New York, but internationally, from Paris to Lima, Peru to Tbilisi, Georgia to Erbil, Iraq. As many as 5 million people are estimated to have marched in the U.S. and 200 locations worldwide. The marches were an extraordinary show of female solidarity, but something else struck me as I watched video feeds of the gatherings from around the world. The men. Untold thousands of them. They had unabashedly joined the marches to voice their support for gender equality. For many of them in the U.S., this wasn't about being a Democrat or a Republican. It was about being human. I'm a typical Trump voter, a 54-year-old white guy. But my mama brought me up correctly, Washington, D.C. marcher Jeff Parker said. Widower Glenn Wallace marched in honor of his late wife. Alexander McCoy, a Marine Corps veteran, marched because I've been led by women before, and my big Marine Corps ego survived just fine. It's time the country sees that following a woman's leadership doesn't make a man weak. And this is why I'm optimistic that despite the issues still confronting women every day, despite intractable issues of misogyny and abuse in some corners, we are closing in on solutions. More men are joining us, reaching across the gender divide to help us close the gap. These men hail from all corners of the country and the world, and from wildly different political viewpoints. They cross socioeconomic, racial, ethnic, and age spectrums. They're taking steps to close the gap at home, in the office, and at school. They may not be calling themselves feminists, as the men in Iceland do, but their actions transcend labels, and they are already making a difference. There are men like Jared Malden, a college student majoring in engineering in Washington State. He decided to take a stand after noticing that his mostly male classmates were dismissive of the women in their program. In a letter to the school newspaper addressed to the women in my engineering classes, he wrote, "You and I are in fact unequal." He listed the obstacles women face, being discouraged from pursuing science, being called bossy, being overlooked by teachers, being considered less qualified in a diversity hire. He concluded, "When I experience success, the assumption of others will be that I earned it. So you and I cannot be equal. You have already conquered far more to be in this field than I will ever face." The letter went viral, the response overwhelmingly positive. As far as he was concerned, that simply proved his point. "I said nothing new," as Malden told NBC's Today show. "The distinguishing factor happens to be that I am a man." Men a few years older than he is are taking a similar stance. One interesting indication came from the Wall Street Journal, which, acknowledging that executive women are frequently asked how they balance work and family, turned the table to ask the same question of 25 male business leaders. As the journal noted, work-life balance isn't a women's issue, but it often feels that way. Some of the journal's most poignant responses were from men in their 50s and beyond, like 55-year-old Dan Glazer, chief executive of professional services firm Marsh & McLennan Companies, who missed out on the childhood activities of his first two children and redoubled his efforts to make time for attending activities like soccer for his third. "When you're younger, you have this sense of your own immortality, and you'll always be able to catch up. You'll make it up to your kid or you'll make it up to your wife," Glazer said. "But your kids are only young once, and you can't get that moment back. Satya Nadella, 49, the chief executive of Microsoft and a father of three, admitted that it's a struggle to balance work and family. Like if I take my daughter to a lacrosse game, how much time am I on the phone versus actually watching her lacrosse game? I strive for a few moments that I'm doing something with them, that I'm actually present. Younger male executives, meanwhile, are setting a different example. Adam Goldenberg, the 35-year-old chief executive of Just Fab, hired an executive coach in order to help him find balance, and ultimately created a plan to make it home for dinner three times a week and block off weekend time to spend with family. Eric Poyer, the young chief executive of Adapar, marks time off on a calendar that's visible to all employees, noting that he's taking his young daughter to the pediatrician or leaving work at 6 to have dinner before her bedtime. His reasoning is that it will help employees feel that they have the company's support for their own personal lives. Men like these are helping drive workplace changes that benefit both sexes. Their influence is apparent in multiple ways, most visibly in new perks like gender-neutral paid parental leaves. The practice started in the tech industry and has since spread to companies including Ernst & Young, 16 weeks, Johnson & Johnson, up to 17 weeks for moms, 9 for dads, and Credit Suisse, 20 weeks, though only for the primary caregiver. Meanwhile, at last count, 5 states have passed mandatory paid parental leave laws, including New York, California, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and Washington, in addition to Washington, D.C. What's more, like the student ambassadors at Harvard, older male executives are starting to join organizations in support of their female colleagues. At male-dominated firms from Bain Consulting, to the law firm Simpson, Thatcher & Bartlett, to the bank MB Financial, the women's groups are beginning to include men in their meetings. When I've spoken to mixed-sex groups like these, I'll notice that nod of recognition among the women in the room when I discuss the subtle indignities, the unconscious bias that we experience. For the men, though, these conversations can be eye-opening, a smack-to-the-forehead moment. Just in the past few years, multiple organizations have sprung up with the goal of uniting men to champion women. Paradigm for Parity, founded in late 2016 by executives including former DuPont CEO Ellen Coleman, calls for equality in the executive suite by 2030 and offers a toolkit of recommended actions, among them unconscious bias training, basing evaluations on performance rather than face time, and providing high-potential women with sponsors who can advance their careers, not just mentors who offer advice. Chief executives of more than 24 companies, most of them men, signed on in support, including those from Bank of America, Coca-Cola, and LinkedIn. An equivalent student effort from the Forte Foundation, a nonprofit founded to encourage women to pursue business education, now invites in men, too. It created a Men as Allies initiative for students and faculty who want to create groups for men who support women on campus. The nonprofit Lean In organization, meanwhile, has a hashtag Lean In Together campaign aimed at bringing in men. Similar efforts are springing up around the globe. In Australia, the Male Champions of Change organization brings together male executives 4 times a year to work on issues including gender pay transparency and flexible work schedules. The men also pledge not to participate in all-male panels. Kenya, for its part, has Men for Gender Equality Now, the 30% Club, started by UK financial executive Helena Morrissey, signs on top executives who support its goal of increasing the percentage of women on boards. Founded in 2010, it now has spread to 6 additional countries, including the US. And the United Nations launched He for She, aimed at men with the express purpose of supporting women, with actress Emma Watson serving as its public face. "Gender equality is your issue, too," Watson said in a UN speech introducing the initiative, imploring the men in the audience to ask yourself, if not me, who? If not now, when? Internationally, these men's groups are often focused on curbing violence against women, which has shown an alarming rise in multiple countries from Indonesia to the UK. In Ecuador, a men's organization called the Cascos Rosa, Pink Helmets, teaches schoolboys to respect women. Men in Argentina, Chile, and Uruguay have joined protests in support of women's rights. a Burundi men's group supporting women's empowerment, the Abatangamuko, literally translates bringing light. In January 2015, He for She and the UN hosted a barbershop meeting, the first of its kind, an international gathering of men brought together to discuss women's issues. Hundreds of men flew in from countries including Pakistan, Tunisia, Latvia, and Sweden. Groups like these are a step in the right direction. But let's be clear, on their own, they aren't enough. For real change to happen, if we are to transform a culture that has long been molded by and for men, it will take individuals one at a time taking a stand, reaching across the gender divide. The wins will come from the accumulation of small, everyday interactions of both women and men. Wharton professor Adam Grant, for example, has made it a practice to intervene when he hears belittling or offensive remarks about women. Sometimes he will simply ask a quiet, gentle question, "What did you mean by that?" It's a non-confrontational approach that often jars men into reflecting on what they've said and why, allowing them to come to their own realization about their behavior. In more extreme cases, Grant takes the offender aside to let him know that others are noticing his behavior and that it is affecting his reputation. Grant also acknowledges his own hidden prejudices. "One of the things men can do is talk about our own biases," he told me. "Men feel judged when you call this stuff out. If you acknowledge your own bias, you level the playing field." Venture capitalist Roger McNamee, for his part, suggests taking one action a day to try to balance the scales. For example, he consciously changed his email style a few years ago to embrace what he describes as a more female approach. He begins each missive with a formal salutation, "Dear Joanne," and introduces his ideas as questions rather than directives, in order to convey collaboration. "The idea is to show respect for the other person," he says, adding, "If enough people do one thing every day, it will matter." The men whose voices populate this book offer multiple other strategies, writ large and small, that will ultimately move us toward a more equitable world. Men like PricewaterhouseCoopers' Robert Moritz, writing about why women are critical to business success, and Brian Well, teaching fellow Googlers to recognize their own unconscious biases, and Sam Polk, calling out the damaging bro talk in the finance industry, and the Container Store's Kip Tindall, speaking about the value female executives bring to decision-making, and Kimberly Clark's Tom Folk, tying bonuses to successful diversity initiatives, and Dr. Augustus White III, explaining cultural illiteracy and how awareness is the key to treating everyone, regardless of gender or ethnicity, with respect. Without question, we still have a long way to go to close the gap. Even the most enlightened men, who are earnestly trying to do so, face structural and cultural forces that are hard to overcome. The thing I am consistently amazed at is how deep this goes, and even people who are regressive still act in ways that are dismissive and disrespectful toward women, Polk told me. It takes vigilance. It takes a lot of hard work. Consulting firm McKinsey & Company's leader, Dominic Barton, the Canadian-born son of a missionary, for example, is one of this country's most outspoken advocates for women. He encourages senior men to mentor up-and-coming women. The firm requires all employees to take unconscious bias training. It used to be voluntary, but the people that have the problem, that are biased, don't come, he told me. It even instituted gender-based recruiting targets to bring in more women in entry-level positions. Barton's ambitious mission is to increase the percentage of female partners to 40% by 2020. Yet in 2016, women accounted for just 11% of senior leadership. "It's been going in the right direction, but it's not fast enough. We haven't solved it," he acknowledges. He's still trying. "Men have a critical role to play," he told me. "It can't just be women." These efforts require courage. Men who defend women sometimes risk not just verbal abuse, but violence. The most benign show of support can spark outrage. When an American Jewish professional group, Men as Allies, asked men to pledge not to participate in all-male panels, The Atlantic magazine was inspired to invite its readers to do the same. The response was so vicious, the magazine had to shut down its comments section. Men face opposition, not just from other men, but from women, too. Some women's groups intentionally exclude men, in part to avoid alienating members. The women's movement remains continuously unwilling to bring men into the fold, as Joshua Ryman wrote in International Affairs Review. Yet allowing men to join would transform their cause from one that is largely by and for women into an all-inclusive social movement. Nevertheless, these men persist, and they are slowly but surely shattering the stigma around men who are openly supportive of gender equality. They give an insight into what it will take for women, and men too, to convince more men to join them. Their strategies vary, but their message is the same. Women aren't going to solve this problem on their own. Men need to see this as their issue too. Ultimately, equality for women means equality for men too. We need to expand the definition of acceptable jobs for boys as much as for girls, especially in an economy that increasingly values traditionally feminine values, like empathy and collaboration. A female surgeon shouldn't raise eyebrows any more than a male nurse does, as Gloria Steinem has observed. I'm glad we've begun to raise our daughters more like our sons, but it will never work until we raise our sons more like our daughters. Millions of men have proven that they are ready and willing to close the gap, but many more are potential partners in this cause. The question becomes then, how can we supercharge these efforts? How do we get more men to understand that this is their issue too? How do we get them to care? In short, how can we bring them into the conversation? Sometimes, all we need to do is ask. For tech executive Steve Boehm, awareness of the gender gap started with a simple question. Years ago, a colleague asked him if he'd ever spoken with a coworker from a different background, a woman or a minority, to inquire what it was like to work at their company. He hadn't. He is the first to admit that back then he hadn't given much thought to the challenges facing women and minorities. But the question prompted him to reevaluate his own attitudes and behavior. 15 years ago, I thought I was a good guy. I treated everybody fairly, he told me. Lots of people are like me. They are well-intentioned, but they don't know what they don't know. Women do know, but we need to go beyond just talking to ourselves. It is time to invite men to join the conversation, too. The men I met in the course of reporting this book and the women who are working to create an equal society for all of us give me great hope. From Glenn Mazzara, ensuring that the women in a television writer's room aren't interrupted, to symphony orchestras showing us every day what an unbiased world looks like, to the scientists peering inside human skulls and the researchers scrutinizing Enron emails, more men are reaching across the gender divide every day. Without question, this is a nascent movement among men. Right now, it's diffuse and largely under the radar, but the people I've met along the way are starting to bring it to the forefront, coalescing around the idea that we need men as well as women working together to close the gap. They are sparking a prominent national conversation. The men and women I met don't pretend to have all the answers, nor do I. Life at work, like life everywhere else, is messy, but my travels helped me, and I hope will help others, to rethink how we look at each other and how we treat each other. Yes, women are still living in a man's world, but every day, more men are reaching across the gender divide. We truly are working side by side, facing forward as we look toward the future, together.